Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to It's All Political, the San Francisco Chronicle's political podcast. I'm Joe Garofoli, the Chronicle's senior political writer, and today our guest is Rob Bonta, the Attorney General of the state of California. Bonta was an assemblyman from Alameda, here in the Bay Area, before Governor Gavin Newsom appointed him earlier this year to replace Javier Becerra, who had joined President Biden's cabinet. Bonta quickly found himself in the middle of a number of contentious issues here, from how police officers are being disciplined to rising crime rates in some parts of the state. Plus, he's already got a run for re-election next year, and he's got two well-funded challengers taking him on: Republican former federal prosecutor Nathan Hochman and independent Anne Marie Schubert, the district attorney of Sacramento. It's shaping up to be one of the marquee races in California next year and in the country. We will talk about all of this with our guest, Rob Bonta, and that conversation starts right now. Attorney General Rob Bonta, from your home in Alameda to my home in Oakland, welcome to It's All Political. We're all still working at home, correct? A little bit.
Yes, a lot. We're starting to get out more. I traveled to San Diego and LA last week, so doing more traveling, but honored to be with you. Thanks, Joe, for having me.
Good to have you here, sir. Before we dive into some of the questions, we're going to talk a little bit about your background. You were born in the Philippines. Your parents were Christian missionaries, correct? And then you grew up in California, and you spent a lot of time that you've said that much of your early life and much of your later life is shaped by the work that they did with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. Tell us briefly a little bit about that and how that has shaped you today.
My parents are my biggest supporters and my biggest inspirations, and I wanted to carry on the legacy that they started, that they inspired me with, and wanted to continue to fight for the values that they showed me were so important to make people's lives better, lift people up, right historic wrongs, and tackle and combat injustice. And, my dad was involved in the civil rights movement. He marched in Selma. He organized for voting rights and civil rights. He was in church with Martin Luther King Jr. He met Stokely Carmichael. Both my parents were involved in the California farm worker movement. They worked for the United Farm Workers of America, first collecting signatures outside of supermarkets in Southern California as part of the lettuce boycott. Later, at the headquarters of the movement, a special magical place called La Paz, where my family of five lived in a trailer a stone's throw away from the home of Cesar Chavez. My dad worked in the front office with Cesar Chavez. My mom in the preschool, she worked with Dolores Huerta. We used to welcome to our trailer and host for Filipino breakfast the great Filipino-American leader who isn't talked about enough, Philip Vera Cruz. And one of the most inspiring things about that movement was that it was a collaborative movement, Latino leaders and Filipino-American leaders fighting side by side to create great wins and victories for everyday people. And then my mom fought for the restoration of democracy in the Philippines. And I grew up going to demonstrations and rallies and protests, Christmas caroling for coins to raise money for the effort, until a dictator was toppled across the ocean and democracy was restored in 1986 with the People Power Revolution. So I saw my parents fight with and for everyday people, committed to a common goal to create success and to right wrongs. And I saw that they could do it. And it made me want to take up the baton and continue the effort. And one of the things I saw, Joe, was that they asked people with titles, people with power, to do things that could help their communities. And sometimes those people would, and sometimes they wouldn't. And I thought, with everything my parents gave me, a great California public school education, believed in me to my dream to go to college and law school, that maybe I could one day be that person with that title, with that authority. And I can bring these communities that have been so long forgotten and overlooked with me in my heart and in my head and fight for them and have a seat in the room, a voice in the room and a seat at the table. So I'm living my California dream, continuing the work that my parents inspired me to do.
To shorthand the story after that, you go from growing up in the trailer, Yale Law School, moving back to California, and now being appointed at some time in the assembly, of course, and then appointed as attorney general. Now for the hard stuff. now all these questions are in front of you. Last month, you announced that your office was going to conduct an independent investigation to the death of Sean Montarosa, who was fatally shot by the Vallejo Police Department on June of 2020. Now, this may happen more frequently because of a new law that goes into effect July 1st. Your office can take over investigations of officer-involved shootings of unarmed civilians across California. So something you've advocated for a while. Walk us through what these independent investigations of a police killing are going to look like. Are you going to send your own investigators? Are you going to be interviewing your own witnesses, conducting your own, scene processing or autopsies? How is it going to work? How is this law going to work now that it's that the Attorney General's office has more power?
We're working through all those details now as we prioritize the implementation of AB 1506, requiring the California Attorney General to conduct independent, thorough investigations of all officer-involved shootings that lead to the death of an unarmed Californian. Historically, that's been about 40 cases per year. And traditionally, the California Attorney General's office has not handled nearly that number of cases. So we are beefing up our infrastructure and our teams to make sure that we can respond as rapidly as possible and get on the scene to work collaboratively with local law enforcement to collect evidence and preserve evidence, to interview witnesses, to interview all of the key players involved in the incident, to make sure that we can conduct a thorough, independent, complete, accurate investigation with full integrity and review it for an appropriate decision and a potential charging decision. And if there is a charging decision, to take that case as far as it needs to go to achieve justice. So we will be involved with local law enforcement as well, who will often be first on the scene, depending on where, what time the incident is and where it is in the state of California. The state of California is a large place, as you know, and a lot of local teams have expertise in collecting and preserving evidence, for example, and we're going to work to make sure that together we have the strongest investigations possible that lead us to the truth and to justice.
So it will be a combination of you'll be reviewing more than just reviewing their sort of investigative homework. You're going to be doing some of your own investigations independently, separately. And would you be doing your own autopsies or scene processing, or are you relying on them for that?
We'll be doing some of our own as well. Yes, like we will definitely be on the scene and doing scene processing whenever possible. If it's impossible, we'll work collaboratively to make sure that we have all the necessary evidence from the scene. Reviewing evidence, including being involved in autopsies and all investigative components from the investigation to the review of the evidence to the charging decision and beyond.
Some conservatives, this will be a theme of the campaign, I'm sure, will have said that California is overcorrected from some of these tough on crime laws and ballot measures from the 90s and such, three strikes and disproportionate sentencing measures. Do you think California is overcorrected, or do you think where do you think we are in that balance? Do you think we're too soft on crime right now? There's been some pushback on that, or do you think we still need to be more forgiving of people?
I think that we need to continue with our commitment, our state's commitment to reform that gets us to safer communities and more justice, more fairness, and more compassion. And we can and we should have all of the above. It is wrong to say that they are mutually exclusive, that you can't have one without the other, that you either have to be safe and have never-ending sentences and mass incarceration and over-criminalization, or you can be just and fair and unsafe. No, that's not true. That is a false narrative, a false dichotomy. You can be, and we should be, safer and more fair and more just. Our system is broken in so many ways. Look at bail. It doesn't even ask about safety. Not one question about safety involved in a bail decision. All it asks about is how much money you have. And I and Senator Hertzberg made the audacious suggestion that we should inquire about safety. It will make us safer if we inquire about safety and risk, and that we can also be more fair and more just and stop punishing poor people for being poor and making the jailhouse door swing open and close based on how much money you have. That's a prime example of how you can be more safe and more just and more fair. Making sure that people have access to automatic expungements, making sure we don't have for-profit private prisons. Those are all appropriate reforms for our criminal justice system while uplifting that very fundamental component of making sure the people of California are safe. That's a top priority for me. It always will be. It's a false narrative and a false dichotomy to suggest anything else.
Speaking of cash bail, you were long been a proponent of doing away with it. But last year, the voters kind of went against that. They rejected Prop 25 that would have killed the cash bail. What did you take from that? And how do you balance what the voters feel and something obviously that you've been working on for many years? And what's next?
I took from Prop 25's failure that the people of California have not yet decided on what the appropriate replacement system is for the fundamentally broken, unsafe, unfair, unjust current money bail system. There was not one political advertisement or campaign ad that I saw or had access to that said, keep money bail as is. It works. It's great. The only criticism was of the proposed replacement system, our risk assessment proposal, the judicial discretion involved in the replacement, pretrial replacement system. So we need to continue to have our discussions and debate and dialogue around what a fair, safe, just pretrial system looks like to replace money bail. We didn't have enough agreement on it at that point, but there is consensus that our current system is broken, doesn't work, and needs replacing. That's how change works, and that's how transformation works. We recognize the problem, and then we decide on what the solution is. The problem, I think, there's unanimity essentially throughout the state of California, or at least a broad consensus, and we still need to identify what the replacement system will be.
You being a Bay Area resident, you know that Walgreens recently closed 17 stores in San Francisco, largely because of the scale of thefts there. So, and some police and retail leaders are blaming that increase on Prop 47, 2014 ballot measure, I believe you supported, that reclassified nonviolent thefts as misdemeanors if the value of the stuff that was ripped off was less than $950. How much do you think, if anything, that Prop 47 has to do with this wave of theft?
I don't know if it's Prop 47. I know a lot of people who are saying that it's the fault of Prop 47 are the people that opposed Prop 47 in the first place. And they're connecting something they see to something that they wish happened, which is the failure of Prop 47. But I don't know that that's what the facts and the data show. We have seen that right now in the state of California, we have one of the lowest levels of crime historically ever. With some areas that need attention and concern appropriately, we do have we have spikes in homicides right now. We have spikes in gun violence. When we do have spikes in property crime, we need to make sure that we have responses that provide accountability, prevention, deterrence, and justice. And so where there are challenges, we must face them and address them. And as California's Attorney General, I'm committed to making sure that all Californians are safe, that we're making sure that folks are being protected from being victims of crime, that those who are victims and survivors are supported, and we have victim-centered programs that provide healing and support and services and recovery and restoration. And that our responses to whatever challenges we see in criminal justice and with crime being committed are addressed in an appropriate way that increases safety while also centering justice and fairness.
A lot of your opponents are going to lump you in with George Gascon and Chesa Boudin, two of the nation's most progressive prosecutors. You've endorsed Gascon in the past and worked with Boudin on the police use of force measures, for example. How do you differ from those two?
DA Gascon and DA Boudin, lead with their heart. I'm my own person with my own approach. And anyone who knows me knows that. It's not a mystery of how I operate, what my values are. I've been doing it in the public for over a decade as a public servant. I work collaboratively to solve problems. I am solution oriented. I'm victim centered, uplifting and supporting victims at all times. I promote safety while also supporting justice and fairness. And that has been, I have a record a mile long that shows that. So, anyone who is trying to compare me to someone else doesn't know me, or is deliberately looking away from my very long, deep, detailed record that is unique in its own way. I'm about solving problems. I'm about supporting people. I'm about generating more opportunity, equity, justice, and inclusion, from ending for-profit private prisons to taking on money bail to having one of the strongest consumer protection laws in the history of our state with ending surprise bills to making sure teachers' pensions are fully funded and teach our hardworking teachers get the pensions that they require to historic medical cannabis policies. I've been proudly part of accomplishments at the state legislature that are historic and paradigm shifting and transformational. And often I've worked across the aisle in that respect with people of different perspectives to find common ground and common solutions that uplift California.
California remains one of only four states without a process for decertifying police officers who have committed some sort of wrongdoing at one agency from jumping to another agency. State Senator Stephen Bradford is a piece of legislation, SB2, that would strip officers of their badges. But right now it's kind of stuck in the legislature. Law enforcement advocates say the panel would decide about how to decertify officers weighs it too heavily against that panel against them. You support this legislation. Why do you support this? And if this is stuck, what's the next step if it doesn't get through the legislature? This, I believe this is its second time trying to get through. What do you do?
Well, we should have a law enforcement officer decertification in the state of California. We pride ourselves in California in being bold, going first, being on the vanguard, the cutting edge, being courageous. We're proud of that phrase. As California goes, so goes the nation. We don't lead when it comes to decertification. We trail. We have catching up to do. There's 46 other states that have done this. This is not controversial. This is something that we should be doing. Everybody knows that if a law enforcement officer commits an egregious act of serious misconduct, which leads to their, qualifies for their termination, that it is not right for them to be fired from one place where they've been hurting members of the public and show up in another police department next door or somewhere else in California and continue to be able to harm the public. There must be consequences in any profession, including my own. As an attorney, we have regulations, we have a state bar, we have individuals who, because of their misconduct, are disbarred and not allowed the privilege of serving. And the same should be held, should be true here in such an important profession. And when there's so many who are meeting their obligations and their duties, for those who don't, there must be consequences. There must be fair due process. And the process must be, appropriate and fair. And when there's a decertification, it's got to stick, and there's got to be consequences. That's what's in the interest of the public. That's what's in the best interest of the profession. So I hope this is something that will get passed through the legislature. I was an author before, while I was still an assembly member, before I had the honor and privilege of being appointed California Attorney General, and I continue to support decertification in California.
We'll have more of our conversation with California Attorney General Rob Bonta after this short break. And now, here's more of our conversation with California Attorney General Rob Bonta.
Let's talk about fentanyl, which has become a huge problem in San Francisco, in addition to many other cities around the country and the state. Last year, there was more deaths from accidental overdoses in San Francisco than there were from COVID. What role do you see as the Attorney General having in this? I know this is a local issue, but is there any place where your office can step in to help or propose different penalties or something?
You know, we are dealing with an opioid epidemic. And, you know, right now that California and many other states and local jurisdictions are involved in discussions on a multi-state, multi-jurisdiction opioid potential settlement. There's litigation throughout the state and the nation involving the different entities that have violated the law in how opioids have been provided to members of the public and have led to such devastation in families and communities throughout the state that have led to addiction, that where there has been overprescription, inadequate regulation, oversight, and accountability, and we need to do better. And should these settlements reach a final conclusion or these litigations get resolved, one component that could be a part of any settlement or litigation is a mitigation fund that will invest in services and programs and support that will help with prevention and with healing and addiction where it's too late for prevention and addiction has already occurred. And there's best practices approaches throughout the state and the nation that could be implemented in our communities that have suffered from opioid abuse and addiction and provide the healing and support and services that are necessary. So we are in the California Department of Justice in the middle of this national effort at the moment. There's no final resolution at this point, but we do see the deep pain in our communities and are committed to having a leadership role to resolve and heal that pain.
Nathan Hochman has backed this measure, which died in the state Senate, SB 350, that said anyone who's convicted of selling drugs will receive a formal written notice that says it's extremely dangerous to human life to manufacture, distribute real or counterfeit controlled substances. If you do so and a person dies and as a result of that action, you'll be charged with involuntary manslaughter or murder. Was that a good idea? Or is that just a feel-good thing? Or is that just kind of toothless? What's your take on that? Or is it something that could be a good foot in the door to nailing some people who are, drug dealers, essentially?
I think we have to be thoughtful and smart about how we provide the accountability. Accountability is needed for, abuse or misuse of how we prescribe very dangerous drugs. And we do have quite a bit of regulation, oversight, and accountability frameworks in place now. And there are consequences when they're violated, but we should be exploring all the different approaches that are smart and fair and thoughtful and effective in helping address the opioid epidemic. You know, generally, in my view, addiction, drug addiction should be treated with as a social service issue. For the folks who are, wrestling with addiction, they should be provided with support and services, rehabilitation programs, not with criminalization. For those who knowingly violate the law, knowing that they will hurt people and prescribe, knowing that people will be harmed and hurt and addicted, there has to be accountability and consequences. I think you're seeing a one proposal to provide that accountability and oversight. Don't know if that's specifically the best approach, but taking on the folks who are hurting others is the foundation of what my role is, to protect everyday people, those who are being hurt, harmed, abused, mistreated from the abuse of power an overreach of those in power and who are hurting others. So I'm going to stand up for the little guy against the big guy. And I think it is important to make sure that the big guy, when they overstep their jurisdiction and overreach of their power and violate the law, that they're held accountable. And that'll be my role.
Let's talk about the death penalty. You are a very staunch opponent of it. The voters of California have spoken twice recently in recent years, 2012, 2016, rejected ballot measures that would have eliminated the death penalty. How do you balance the law with your personal opinions and feelings and where the voters are right now? How are you balancing that, and how would you balance that as the Attorney General?
I am personally very vehemently against the death penalty. It has not proved to be a deterrent. It is racist in that individuals who, in cases where the victim is white, the individual is more likely to get the death penalty than when the victim is not white. It is something that is irreversible, the death penalty as a punishment. And it is also something that is fallible, that is wrong. And when you're irreversible, you can't be wrong. But we are. We know that we have people on death row or who have been convicted and to death and their sentence carried out, who were, you know, there's DNA evidence showing that they should not have been given the death penalty. So it's problematic and wrong in so many ways. I do not believe it's right for California. I don't know where California is right now at this moment. Those are propositions that were on the ballot in the past under, in certain political circumstances and environments. I think California is moving away from the death penalty and at some point will not have it anymore. Right now, we have it. And so I will balance my commitments and my responsibility and duties and obligations as a California Attorney General with my personal views. And if there are ways to be more fair and consistent with the law, we'll explore those and we'll implement those as appropriate. I'm aware of my obligations as they stand side by side with my personal beliefs.
And would you, if there was a ballot measure that came up that would eliminate the death penalty, would you hesitate to support it?
I would not hesitate to support it.
As for our listeners, that is something a couple of your predecessors did not. They kind of Kamala Harris and I believe Jerry Brown sort of stood in the sidelines when maybe not Jerry Brown. I'm sorry, that was Kamala Harris on both sides.
One thing I will say in that regard is I have responsibility for title and summary, as you know, and so making sure that that is done, calling balls and strikes impartially is going to be important as well. The appearance of impartiality is important as well. But there is no lack of clarity in my opposition to the death penalty.
The Attorney General's race next year may be one of the most exciting ones on the ballot. You already have two, especially for you being one of the candidates. You have already have two opponents, and they're raising decent money, as I'm sure you know. Tell us how you are different from Anne-Marie Schubert, the district attorney in Sacramento County, and Nathan Hochman. We've mentioned him a couple of times, former prosecutor, federal prosecutor, and worked in the National Department of Justice. Well, how are you different from these folks?
I think I'm very unique, and the sitting California Attorney General, the approach that I have, the record that I have, the values that I've uplifted and fought for are absolutely unique and nowhere else to be seen in this race. My view of the Attorney General's office is that, and the Attorney General's role is that I'm the people's attorney, that I'm there to fight for everyday people. And to make sure, especially that our most vulnerable, voiceless, hurt, harmed, abused, mistreated, cast aside, forgotten, are always taken care of. That I will make the fights of Californians my fights, and be there for them. Whether it's being hurt by big polluters and having in your as a community that's forced to drink dirty water or breathe unhealthy air, or being cheated by a scam or a fraud, or being hurt by a big corporation, being hurt by the many broken parts of the criminal justice system, being victimized by perpetrators of hate, and the list goes on: human trafficking, elder abuse, child exploitation. My goal every day is to roll up my sleeves and fight for the people of this state, and to make their lives better, to take on injustice, take on abusers, and be the champion that the people of California deserve. I don't think anyone else has that framework, that approach, and that record of success in that space. That's why I got into service. We started talking about my parents and the civil rights movements and social justice movements that they've been a part of. That's what drives me and inspires me. So, I get up every day thinking about and being excited about how I can help the people of California today. And that's unique in this race.
Kamala Harris used to refer to herself when she had your job as the state's top cop. Do you think of yourself in that way too?
I think of myself as the people's attorney, and that takes on a lot of different roles. It certainly does have a critical role in leadership for our law enforcement community and our criminal justice system, something that I'm proud of and honored to have such a critical role in. But much of what the Attorney General does is civil. And it, you know, suing big polluters and corporations for anti-competitive activity, and making sure that people have access to affordable, high-quality healthcare, the list goes on and on. So I think the frame of the people's attorney to make the people's fights my fight and to take on abusers and perpetrators of injustice is how I see the role.
The other day, I interviewed and wrote about another Bonta who is running for office. Your wife, Mia Bonta, who you refer to frequently as the better Bonta. To be fair, she gets a lot of heat because, and you do too. She's raised a lot of money, and they said people are giving to Mia because they want to suck up to the Attorney General. They want to, you are not, as you say, you're not only the Attorney General, but you also write title and summary on ballot measures. And some of that money coming to you and to your wife is from people who with those interests. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Mia stands on her own two feet. She always has since I've known her when she was 17 years old. Stands on her own two feet and more. She puts people on her back and carries them forward and lifts people up. And, we've been partners in life and partners in service since we were 17 years old. She's running an incredible campaign, inspiring constituents throughout the district and people throughout the state as the powerful, passionate, values-based social justice warrior leader that she is. And I think there's a tinge of sexism, frankly, in folks who say she's being treated or her success or her powerful campaign is somehow attributable to her husband. As long as I've known her, she's always done it on her own, fiercely, powerfully, committed, and skillfully. And it might be a surprise to some, but not a surprise to me that she's mounting such an incredible campaign. So, she's earned all the support that she has. I'm proud of her. There's no one I'm more proud of. She's someone who's inspired me for years. So I'm excited. I just think it's incredible that she's willing to serve, and the people of this district would be lucky to have her as their assembly member, and as someone who's seen her up and close and how personal, and someone who actually had the just the incredible distinct pride and honor of serving this assembly district. I believe the most woke, enlightened, social justice oriented district in the whole state. I know what it takes to be the assembly member and legislator that this district deserves. And Mia has everything and more. And she does it all on her own two feet.
And she told me that you guys have basically, as you said, since 17, you met the week before, is like a freshman orientation for minority students, as they were called in those days, at Yale. And you start dating that week, and you've been together ever since. 32 years, I guess that is, put a fine point on it.
Yeah, it is 32 years. Yes. And, I knew she was special from day one, and I'm glad she took pity on me. I'm glad that she saw the potential in me as someone who had a mullet and a fanny pack and flip flops with socks.
Oh,
it was not pretty, but she saw the potential.
My God. A mullet and a fanny pack.
Joe, it was outrageous.
I don't know. She might not be the better boss. She went out with you looking
she
like
saw
that.
Saw the potential and turned me into someone semi-respectable, and I emphasize semi. She's been working miracles ever since then, and it's been an honor just to see her work and to be her partner in life and service. But yeah, we met when we were 17 for an orientation program for students of color a week before college started.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. And thank you so much for being on It's All Political.
Thanks for having me, Joe. An honor. Look forward to the next time.
I'd like to thank you all for listening and hope that you and your friends and family are safe and healthy. I'd like to thank Attorney General Bonta for being here today. I'd like to thank Karen Creighton for producing this episode. A shout out to our theme music that you're listening to right now. That song is called Cattle Call, and it's written by Randy Clark and performed by Randy Clark and Crow Song. Talk to you next time.